Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books Network podcast. I'm Roberto Mazza, the host of the Jerusalem Unplugged podcast, and today, for the Middle Eastern Studies series, my guest is Louis Fishman. Louis is associate professor at Brooklyn College, New York, and is the author of Jews and Palestinians in the Late Ottoman Era, 1908-1914, published by Edinburgh University Press in 2020. Louis, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
Louis, the first question I want to ask you is very much about yourself. So can you tell us a little bit about your background before we talk about the book?
Yeah, thanks so much for asking that question. People sometimes get confused, I would say. I was actually born in the U.S. and went to Israel as a youngster. And I finished my BA there at Haifa University. So I was doing Middle East history. Basically, I come from Middle East history. This was in the 1990s, so this is way before the internet and way before smartphones and different things like this. And of course, my classes were all in Hebrew, and I studied Arabic there. And from there, you know, just quickly, briefly, at Haifa University, I was lucky to have great professors like Boutros Abomani and then Ilan Pape that works on the conflict quite a bit. And I also had David Kushner, who works on the Ottoman era of late Ottoman Palestine. So, of course, when you're a BA, you don't really understand where this is going. And I remember when I'm applying to University of Chicago and other universities is that we didn't have internet then, and we had to read about them. We had to go to libraries, read about them, write letters, and send them off in you know, the post office. And I got accepted to University of Chicago, which was an absolute thrill. I can tell you back then, I really didn't understand what I was embarking on when I get accepted to MA PhD program. But I knew that I was going to Chicago and I was going to study with someone named Rashid Khaledi. And Rashid Khaledi would be then, even before he had written his, you know, book, Palestinian Identity, was known as a scholar who worked on Palestinian issues. So it was really exciting for me as someone, as an Israeli coming to the United States to study at Chicago. It was a very different world, let me put it, back then. But I also did at Chicago, I was in Near Eastern Language and Civilization. So I did Islam. We had to do a whole section on Islam. So I studied the Quran and I studied different. It was a more very Orientalist type department. But I did continue on with Rashid Khaledi to work. And I also worked with a professor named Hasan Kayala, who was outstanding on Turkish, late Ottoman relations, Turkish-Arab relations, superb scholar. So, you know, if between having Wadat Qadi, she was the most amazing person you could read Quran with, and Rashid Khaledi, these were my two favorite professors there. And then Kayala was a visiting professor. I think I really did. I got a lot there. Now, of course, I wasn't going to even thinking about Ottoman. You know, Chicago's known for the Ottoman program, and I didn't really take Ottoman classes there towards the end. And when I was studying with Professor Khaledi, I did my MA on the 1970s. It's called Yom al-Ard, Land Day, on protests that took place among the Palestinian citizens of the State of Israel in the 1970s. Then I went back to the 1930s. And finally, for my PhD, I figured, you know what? I really want to go back to the Ottoman era. And that's when I embarked on my dissertation. This book is inspired from the dissertation, quite similar in some ways, but very different in other ways. Let me just finish. By then, my life takes a turn. And in 1999, I end up in, I had just finished my coursework. I end up in Ankara, Turkey. And that's where that's became my second or third home. And since then, I've been 2 years later, I moved to Istanbul, where I did my research in the Ottoman archives on the topic we're going to be talking about today. And I really, 2008, started a blog, Istanbul, Tel Aviv, New York, named after the three cities I live in. And since then, I've been living in those three cities. Today, I teach at Brooklyn College, but I regularly go back to my home in Istanbul and also go back to Tel Aviv, where I live part-time as well.
Fascinating story. Now, this book is the story of how, following the 1908 Young Turks Revolution in Istanbul, Palestinians and Jews negotiated their political communities in Palestine. Later on, you will also talk about how they negotiated the same in Istanbul. Can you set for us the context of this story?
You know, that's a great question, because I think when we write our dissertations, I think we're still, everything's very much theoretical. And I was lucky to put my dissertation aside and dabble in journalism for quite a few years and come back to my work when I was writing my book. And I think the context is what I got when I came back to that book. And that was understanding that a Ottoman Jerusalem was an integral part of the empire, and Jews and Palestinians never foresaw that the empire is just going to disappear or is going to break up. And they didn't really foresee that the British would eventually colonize Palestine. Now, having said that, of course, that was one of the greatest fears of the Palestinians, besides Zionism, was that fear of British colonialism. So I'm not saying that there was no sense that it could happen, but no one foresaw that was going to happen so quickly in the way it did. So I think if we go back to the pre-World War I era and we look at these communities, of course, the Jewish community, absolute minority, it's a very small community, which I call made up of a hodgepodge of communities, whether they're Jews from originally from Europe or Ashkenazim or Sephardim, Jews speaking Ladino, coming originally from Spain, living within the integral to the Ottoman Empire, and of course Arabic and Persian speaking Jews in Jerusalem, among other groups. So when we talk about the Jewish community, or what we call the Jewish Yeshuv, that really is a very multi, what do you say, that if we go back to the Yeshuv, we see that it is a very mixed community, very diverse community. But by 1908, that community starts uniting by adopting the Hebrew language as their main language of communication with each other within that context.
Can you also tell us a little bit more about sort of the historical context? Perhaps some of the listeners might not be super familiar with, the events of 1908, and how was the revolution received in Palestine?
Yeah, you know, that. First of all, I think even if we look back before the revolution, Palestine, you know, we have this idea that, you know, in my book, I argue against the idea that there's, you know, Palestine was sort of this quiet, peaceful place before the rise of Zionism. We see that in the 17th, 18th, 19th century, always there's some contest over the land by different groups. And the Ottomans really had very loose control of the provinces at time. There wasn't always direct control. But by the mid-19th century, as the Ottomans are reforming their own state, which are called the Tanzimat era, they're also bringing the provinces closer by implementing a strict sense of centralization. So through that centralization, really by the first parliament under Abdul Hamid II in the 1870s, mid-1870s, you see that Jerusalem has a representative, Yusuf Dia El-Khaledi. So we have a sense already that Palestinians or Arabs are becoming much more connected to the center. Now, by 1908, during this, the first constitutional period is known that it almost didn't exist. Right when it starts, they have a parliament, they have a constitution that is suspended. And the 1908 Young Turk Revolution is saying across the board, the majority of Ottoman citizens, be them Armenian, be them Muslim, be them Jewish, from the different groups within the Ottoman Empire, Greek, the far majority of people are saying, we want change. We want you to Sultan Abdulhamid II, we are demanding that you reopen the parliament and that you reinstate the constitution. So the post-19 July 1908 constitution is a radical period in Ottoman history where suddenly you have this boom in the press, for example. Just in Palestine alone, you're going to have around 10 newspapers that start up. We have smaller ones that are the main newspapers, but we have three Arabic newspapers, three Hebrew newspapers within 2 or 3 years of the Young Turk Revolution. So Young Turk Revolution was a moment where everyone supported this idea of equality, of justice. And in this idea, Ottomanism transformed to a new sense of a civic identity. In the sense that it doesn't matter if you are a Turkish Muslim or Arab Muslim, or if you're a Jewish person in Izmir speaking Ladino, or if you're a Bulgarian speaking a Bulgarian Greek, so on and so forth, that everyone is going to be able to adopt this idea of equality. Now, we know the outcome of this would be the massacre of Armenians in 1915, the Armenian Genocide. We also know that they lose the Balkans, and there's massacres of Muslims with hundreds of thousands of Muslims coming in to the Ottoman Empire. And there's a shaking up of that empire in the World War I era, or even a year or 2 years before this. But that little window of time, that 1908 to 1914, is a moment that gave all these different groups, whether the majority groups or the minority groups, some sense of hope. And it's that period that I work on, where Jews and Arabs are sitting together very much, not just theoretically, literally at the same banquets and at the same meetings, and saying, let's create a new Ottoman identity. What I show in my book, though, what turns out is something very, very different. And that's more of a contest between the different communities, and we can come to that. But the 1908 period really was a euphoric period. And it was not only for just Ottoman Jews. It really transformed the Zionist community in saying to themselves, if we want anything, we'll be able to achieve an autonomous homeland under the Ottoman system. So even the Zionist movement by late 1909 rejects the idea of an independent state. They are now saying we want the autonomous land in Palestine. And what does that mean? A Jewish-speaking community that is independent and that's able to develop itself and its own culture. So in that sense, they mirrored in the post-1908 revolution other minority groups within the Ottoman sphere, such as the Armenians. We can talk about that more, Armenians and Greeks, where they said, on one hand, we can have sort of cultural autonomy, speak Armenian. On the other hand, we're going to be proud Ottoman citizens represented in the parliament. So this is the idea of the 1908 revolution. Now, of course, by March 1909, it goes sour. There's a counter-revolution. And politics gets more and more to become and expressed also through violence. And I think that's what we see the massacre of the Armenians in 1909 also, which is a new book by Bedros Dermatesian about this event also. And he also writes about the Young Turk period as well. So yeah, so it's a very exciting period. I'll just end by saying that my book comes after two or three books that have been looking at Ottoman Palestine, whether it's Michelle Campos's book, Ottoman Brothers, and Abigail Jacobson's books on this era. So what we see is that historians started to see things that were basically unknown up until a few years ago, about a decade and a half ago.
I also believe that it's important to stress what you said earlier in methodological terms, the fact that we cannot read history backwards. And so we have to remember that both Palestinians, Jews, and Zionists could not foresee the end of the Ottoman Empire, and therefore their work was still within the same Ottoman context. And so I was wondering if you can briefly give us a sense of your methodological approach and the sources used in your work.
Yeah, I wrote that part about not reading history backward. I think after post, it wasn't in my dissertation. That was part of my book. And once I started understanding that Zionist history and oddly enough, Palestinian history itself has been written within that framework very much of Zionist history. So I always said that if we look at the Palestinians, we've best basically read the majority through the lens of the minority. Meaning Palestinians have only become important when they're connected to the conflict. And if they're not connected to the conflict, we really don't know too much about them or what they're doing. This is very different than, let's say, Arabs in Syria or Egypt or different places. So if we start at 1948 and read history backwards, this is how the Zionist narrative and later the Israeli narrative was created. The Israeli narrative is created saying, okay, we have a state in 1948. Now, how did we get here? Well, we got here, there was World War II, and then the Holocaust plays a huge part in this, but there was already a Jewish yeshuv, and there was already a conflict before the Holocaust, of course. And then they go back the British mandate, the Balfour Declaration, the Second Aliyah, and the First Aliyah, the waves of immigration. So it's a very smooth line. So I wanted to break that smoothness up and say it's really too smooth. So in terms of methodology, is I spent a lot of time, and it's something I'm continuing to do on a weekly basis now after my book is out, is I sit and I read the newspapers for hours on end, days on end, weeks on end. And remember, we didn't have search engines back then. In Palestine, we still don't have a search engine. But for the Hebrew newspapers, I was doing microfilm. Or microfiche, I don't remember what it's called nowadays, right? The idea that we would sit there and roll and look at these bad prints for hours on end. But by doing that, I really was able to capture that most of the history that is written about, even Israeli history, is not covered. What we're reading in the newspapers is not covered in the official Israeli history. And what we're reading about Palestinians is not covered at all in the Palestinian history, almost. And like I said, the Palestinian history, to a great extent, was written in reaction to that Zionist history. So just an example, I've been reading the last 3 or 4 months of Palestine, 1911. I'm seeing very many different aspects I found in my book. What interests them is the fear of colonialism. Meaning in 1911, Zionism was there, but that British colonial fear was very, very apparent during this period. They have Egypt right next to them under British occupation. India is there. And I find in my book that Palestine and Iraq are very comparable during this period in some of their fears, some of their disputes with the Ottoman authorities as well. And that's something I would like to develop in the future. Now, so when you go back in this, and you start reading the newspapers, you start finding, and it doesn't have to be in the Arabic or the Hebrew or the Ottoman press. The Ottoman press now has a search engine. So I'm able to go over and find different things that we never knew existed. And then you start seeing, wait a minute, the debates then don't really match the historical debates. Now, I have to say that at times it's frustrating. It's frustrating because you're basically coming and saying, well, all this work is great of different friends and different, older professors. But yes, all of their work is, I'm not saying that this work is going to undermine anyone's work so much that their work is no longer relevant. But a lot of it, we're going to see that the way we understand Palestine, I think, is going to transform greatly in the next 20 years. The more scholars we bring in, and the more people that read these newspapers, and they read the Ottoman documents. Of course, the other way I got this was going into the Ottoman archives. Now, when I went to Ottoman archives, I was convinced I would find tons on Zionism. And I found surprisingly little on Zionism. But I'll give you an example. I found the topic of my third chapter, the Haram al-Sharif incident, which was an article in Journal of Palestine Studies before that. Most dossiers in the Ottoman archives are 3 to 4 pages. They give you very little information. It's a letter sent to Jerusalem. There was a fight in a neighborhood between different Christian groups. It can be. It doesn't have to be Jews and Arabs, of course, right? They have different things. They send it to the Jerusalem governor. The governor writes back to Istanbul and said, no, there's no truth to this. It was a little fight, but nothing really came of this. And it ends that way. But when you come to the Haram al-Sharif incident, which is the archaeological dig that took place in the Temple Mount area in 1911 by a British archaeological team, that this year alone, 4 books have been written on that. 4 books, novels have been written. Well, 2 novels, one sort of semi-historical, and another one in the works. So a man named Captain Parker comes. He digs on the Haram, within the Haram al-Sharif, the Temple Mount, and all hell breaks loose. Near riots. It's the biggest event in Palestine between 1908 and 1914. And up until 15 years ago, not one article about it. No one knew about it, in fact. But if you go to the papers, you'll see it's everywhere. You go to the New York Times, you go to the London Times, you go to India, I'm sure you'll find articles written in it, because there was a delegation coming from India saying, well, the Islamic holy sites have been desecrated. It's absolutely huge. So that's exactly what that sort of highlights what I'm talking about. Now, going back to the Ottoman dossier was about 120 pages long. And I have to tell you that I have to go back to it. Originally, I said, this should be my first book. And then I said, well, all these people are writing, and there's a nice article in the New York Times by the great-granddaughter, the great-great-niece of Captain Parker. And she works in the New York Times. Suddenly, I forgot her name, of course. I can get it, though. She wrote about her own... let me stop her there. I got like that. They'll take this out. Okay. So anyways... So there's 4 books about it. And I said to myself, wait a minute, you know what? There still might be room for another small book about this. And all the Ottoman debates about this going on in this one dossier. So there's still a lot that people don't even know about this. I'll end by saying that every archaeologist in Jerusalem knows about the Parker tunnels. To them, this is no mystery. There was a person that came and dug under the Temple Mount for 3 years looking for treasure. He didn't find it. He created these important, cleared out these old ancient tunnels. Okay? So what I'm saying is that as historians, we were so fixated on the conflict that we missed other things that what I call make Palestinians Palestinians, that give them a whole life outside of that conflict. Remember, they are the majority, and the Jews are the minority, about 15%. Jews were at the most around 100,000. Palestinians then were around 700,000. Some scholars put it at 10%, 12%. All the work I'm seeing is about 15%, right at 1914, right at the war. So this is something that shows us that there's still a lot of things to uncover in terms of the political and social history of the period.
I want to thank you because you anticipated a question I had about this particular chapter. Given that archaeology is a very controversial topic, particularly in the current era, where archaeology is being politicized and weaponized in a sense, and is a very cogent and important element in order to understand, as I said, the contemporary issues. But let me go back to your chapter two, where essentially you start discussing very much the question of a Palestinian collective identity. And one of the fascinating parts of this chapter is that you're looking at the role of peasantry. Again, another sort of a community that often has been neglected and forgotten by historians, certainly pre-2000. So how did a collective Palestinian identity emerge? And what was the role of peasants?
Thanks for that very good question. I mean, what is interesting is that, A, we see peasants have agency. They, through their mukhtars, the village leaders, and through other independent factors, are writing directly to the Ottomans, complaining that Zionist Jews are coming and buying their land and throwing them off this land. And this is around 1910-1911. So A, the peasants were very well aware that their future was endangered by this new Jewish immigration. Now, for most Palestinians in the urban arena, they couldn't foresee that this was any danger whatsoever. They, at times, looked positive upon the Jewish community and the immigrants. We know from Jonathan Gribbett's book that Ruhi Al-Khaledi, the MP who I write about, the member of parliament from Jerusalem, met quite often with Eliezer ben Yehuda, who's seen as the father of modern Hebrew, which I debate a bit also, but he was very, very, they met and they discussed events together on a fairly, it happened quite often, actually, I don't want to say weekly basis, but they met quite a bit to discuss issues in Palestine. So the urban arena, by 1912-13, start to see that the peasants are very, very upset, and they almost feel that they're being sold out by their own notables. Now, well, we have an interesting dynamic here. And if we look at the Egyptian history to the early 20th century, the Denshowe incidents, which I include in my book, we see that it's when the urban journalists and the politicians come together to adopt the peasant cause that you create a sense of national identity before they can even foresee that they're going to be an independent state. So what we call, I would call local patriotism. And this local patriotism in Palestine emerges around this period, where you have on one hand the traditional notables in Jerusalem. They're the El-Husseini family, the Nashashibi family, the Khaledi family. They're on one hand. And we have this division of labor from among them, how they interact with the Ottomans. Ottomans have the politics of the notables, where they delegate work to each family and they try not to set off an imbalance between the power between the different families. And that's going to affect Palestinian nationalism or the inability to unite at times all the way up through the 1950s, you could argue. And on the other hand, you have the journalists who are mostly Christian during this period. You have, for example, Isa al-Isa of the newspaper Philistine, which means Palestine. So what we see is that we have a coming together of the different groups where the work to delegate the newspapers is actually by Christian editors. Now, these Christian editors, what makes these papers Palestinian papers and not just Christian papers or Arab Christian papers is they start, especially in Philistine, but of course in Haifa and El Carmel, they start adopting the cause of the peasant on one hand. They start reiterating these ideas of Palestinianist or what I call Palestinianism during this period, by reminding their readers that this is happening within the land of Philistine. And they are a pressure point to some extent on the notables in Jerusalem to act. So by 1914, you really have, for the first time, a conscious Palestinian identity, you could argue. And that is this idea of a local patriotism, of them joining together to protect the homeland, or what I argue in the book, to make claim over the homeland. Now remember, they see the Jewish community and the growing Jewish community and the growing autonomy of the Jewish community as a threat. But without the peasants, the picture would be completely different. We can't say that in history without. But they are a key part to this. I think there's a lot more work to be done on this also. Now we see interesting exchanges during this period and also in Bisan. So we have Al-Masri, which is Nazareth in the north, and you have Bisan near the Jordan River. And this is where you have fears that the Ottomans are going to sell huge tracts of lands to the Zionists during this period, the former lands of Abdulhamid II. So these are flashpoints of conflict. Less Bisan, more Nazareth, right? This area of Fula. These are flashpoints of conflict. Now we always, from the very beginning of Jewish colonization, we have conflicts. But these conflicts should not be placed within that national framework. These conflicts, you had Jewish farmers in Anatolia at the same time. This is when later on we can talk about my new work, what I'm doing. But the idea of the what we call the first immigration, the first Aliyah, was these farming communities that were really should be seen as a sense of pride among many of the urban folk, a bit of anomaly, a bit strange in the sense that who are these people going out to farm? But this was the moment that we have for the Jewish community a really big transformation in itself to becoming independent also. So for the first 20 years or so, most of the Palestinians don't see this the colonies as some kind of threat. But by 1908, it's actually the strengthening of the urban community that poses a threat. By 1912, we see that they're becoming more and more independent, more autonomous. And this has been written out of the history. The history has been written of conflict going back to 1880s, 1890s, and mostly looking at the rural areas of settler colonialism and so forth and so on. But I would argue that it's actually the urban local Jewish communities and the divisions. And I'll end here. It's very important that while you had some kind of communal relations between Jews and Arabs within the urban arena, definitely you had. You could see each other at weddings. You could be Jews and Arabs working together often. But this didn't extend towards the peasants. And the Jewish groups, including the Sephardic Arabic-speaking Jews, really saw no connection between them and the peasants. And I think that's something that should be really, really clear. The Jewish community, even the Arabic-speaking Jewish communities, were very different than, let's say, the Cairo Jewish community or the Baghdad Jewish community, where you see that they're starting to unite under an Iraqi identity or under Egyptian identity. In Palestine, I claim that for the most part, overall, the Palestinian identity was only Christians and Muslims, and the new Jewish identity, of course, was bringing that hodgepodge of communities into one overarching community connected through Hebrew and pride of building the Jewish homeland, the modern Jewish homeland within Palestine.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
In the second part of the book, since you talked about now the Palestinians, you are talking more about the Jews, the Jewish communities and Zionists in Palestine, but also Istanbul. Now, you already mentioned a few elements earlier, but I was wondering, who were the Jews in Palestine at the beginning of the 20th century? For instance, you argue that Jewish communities previously were loosely connected, then at some point united together. How and why?
Yeah, that's a great question. There's a lot of interplay here between, we have so many different things happening at this one time. You know, I tell my students to rise up to the sky and then look down. And you'll start seeing that so many different things are happening. You have the Young Turk Revolution on one side. You have the death of Herzl on the other in 1904, where after this, the Zionist movement is only looking at Palestine. They forfeited the idea of having a homeland in Uganda, for example. But you do still have territorialists during this period. And when you have debates in the Ottoman Istanbul, for example, of a Jewish homeland and buying land, it's actually the territorialists who are trying to cut a deal to make what would become Iraq, Mesopotamia, a Jewish homeland. So what we see is that during this period, we have many things happening. Now, what's happening in Palestine? One, a growing sense of Ottoman identity, Ottoman patriotism, that's going to unite different groups. Some of them are the immigrant groups. Some of them are the Arabic-speaking Jews who were mostly often immigrant groups who had came in often in the 1870s from North Africa. And you also have older Jewish communities that had been there. You even have a traditional Hasidic community. But what you see in all their newspapers by 1910, 1911, is this growing sense of we are living within the Ottoman sphere. And what does that mean for us? For many, that is, and especially the Sephardic community and the newer generation of Ashkenazis that are born there in these farming communities, is let's connect ourselves with the capital. And that's with Istanbul. So we see during this period, this new identity arising where you have Ashkenazi Jews who their parents immigrated to farming communities within the different areas of Palestine, connecting with Jews who were children of immigrants in Jerusalem from more traditional religious homes, connecting with Jewish people in from North Africa who are in Jaffa, for example. And all of these more modern groups, modernization also meant adopting more of an Ottoman identity, seizing the moment and saying, we are here, let's promote Hebrew as our first language, Ottoman, Turkish as our second language, and for many, the third language would be Arabic. But that's sort of pushed aside. And in fact, what we're going to see is that, surprisingly at times, it's actually the Ashkenazi community that's speaking Arabic quite well, the ones that are in the farming communities that have a relations with Arabs on the day-to-day basis, where some of the traditional Sephardic Jews or Arab-speaking Jews didn't know how to read or write Arabic. That's very, very important. they often were reading Arabic in Hebrew characters, in Judeo-Arabic. So that idea that, you know, many people have, quite a few scholars have been trying to connect them and say that they were closer to Palestinians somehow, the Arabic-speaking Jews, which I don't see whatsoever. In fact, I see the opposite. I see that these are very small, conservative communities. In fact, the Jewish community in Palestine overall, and then you could compare it with the Arab community, is that they are quite conservative. And for example, where in Beirut, we're going to be seeing in Cairo, Beirut, other places, we'll see much more, we'll see many more women journalists, for example, which we don't see in Palestine. It's still very conservative in that sense. So what we have is this Jewish community post-1908 uniting together. And whether it's the Moriah, which is the religious newspaper, Ashkenazi, more leaning towards Hasidic, you have Hatzvi, which is the father of modern Hebrew, Eliezer ben Yehuda's paper, and you have HaChirut, which is the Sephardic newspaper, is that you do have this interchange of what we want the Jewish Yeshuv to look like. Under what does a modern Jewish community look like? And they all adopt this idea of Hebrew. And that's very important. So that doesn't mean integration, complete integration, but it does mean creating a new, constructing this idea of a Hebrew identity. And I think that's key. Let me end by saying this also is the post-1908 Young Turk Revolution also brings politicians, Ottoman Jewish politicians who are in the parliament, who support Zionism, not as a separate ideology or a separate state, but as sort of Jewish pride. So we have that also happening in Istanbul at the same time.
And I want to ask you something about sort of this connection that you make with Istanbul. So how would you define the relationship between the Ottomans and the Zionists in this period of time? And I think it's important also that to highlight the fact that you are extending the border of Palestinian and Zionist and Jewish history in a sense that you're connecting the dots of these communities with the center of the empire.
Yeah, you know, without understanding the dynamics and the tensions between the Young Turks and their opposition, the Committee of Union Progress, who were in power, and their opposition, the Liberal Entente and different groups, it's very hard to understand what's happening in Palestine. Because oddly enough, the representatives of Palestine in the parliament are, I mentioned before, Ruhi al-Khaladi and Saeed al-Husseini and two other people, one from Akka and Jaffa. But the one from Jerusalem are on the side of the CUP, which is being accused of being pro-Zionist. Now, the CUP, the Committee of Union and Progress, has people like the MP Karaso from Salonika, and they have someone named Nisi Mazliach from Izmir. And he's a diehard pro-CUP, pro-Jewish community. I mean, the same time this is happening, the Jewish community in Istanbul and Izmir and the more traditional and Salonika are saying, let's be proud citizens, let's speak Turkish. Because most of the communities are still speaking Ladino. But at the same time, we're staunchly against the state, but Zionism can be understood as a cultural movement similar to those of Armenians who want to speak Armenian Greeks. So they come up with this formula where for them Zionism means that they're going to teach kids modern Hebrew in kindergarten. Okay, and that's it. And they're going to support the Jewish community in Palestine. Now here we're going to get a really mixed up situation here. Quite confusing. Because as they support the Jewish community in Palestine, some of them are staunch anti-Zionist. One of them has been over and over in literature. You have two people. One in Palestine, Albert Entebbe, who has been seen as someone who was a Ottoman protege, the model Ottoman with the tarbush. He spoke Turkish. He spoke Arabic. He's originally from Damascus. He's not from Palestine. That's very, very important. Because, you know, he goes to France, and then he gets educated, and then he comes to Palestine as the head of the Aniyan school. He also spoke Hebrew quite well. But the Jews in Damascus are speaking less Hebrew than the local Jews, okay, in Palestine. That's very, very, that's also important. So we have someone that has been seen over and over again as an anti-Zionist. And in their books, they write him sort of as he was in opposition of the Jewish Yishuv. No, the opposite holds true. He was anti-Zionist, meaning he was anti-pro-Jewish state. He definitely was for strengthening the independent Jewish community in Palestine. He definitely was for strengthening Hebrew language and the Hebrew institutions in the city itself. So then on the other hand, you have the chief rabbi, Chaim Nachum, who is anti-Zionist. But it was through the connections of the Jewish Yishuv, the Sephardic Jewish Yishuv, through their connections with Chaim Nachum, okay, that they're able to close Philistine, the newspaper, two or three times for being discriminatory against Jewish people. Okay? Saying that Zionism, anti-Zionism, is anti-Semitism when it's done by Palestinians. This debate already comes up then, right? Anti-Zionism equals anti-Semitism already comes up during the Ottoman period. So what we have here is, yes, they're anti-Zionist, and many histories look at them as sort of being, you know, these enlightened Jews that didn't choose the Zionist way. And if only everyone chose their way, things would have been much different. No, they were pro-Jewish Yishuv. They were pro-Jewish community. They were pro-speaking Hebrew. They took pride over this in this community. And connecting this to Chaim Nachum was close to many people in the CUP. And the fact that the Jews were so close, so popular among some of the, you have two or three very big MPs, that you really have the beginnings, what I talk of, a modern anti-Semitism within Istanbul. And the anti-Zionist movement is going to start connecting the anti-Semitic movement. Now, let me tell you, this gets confusing, that the two MPs in Jerusalem are on the pro-government side. That puts them on the Jewish side. The Palestinians are placed on the Jewish side. And they're saying, there's no conspiracy here. We don't hate Jews. In fact, we like Jews. In fact, we study with Jews. And some of them study at the Allianz Israeli, the school, some of the Arab MPs. So the Palestinians are going to have an extra weight on them, defending their right to Palestine and saying, we're not anti-Jewish, we're not anti-Semitic, and being part of the government. Now this, by 1912, 1913, really starts, the two sides start separating, and the Palestinians really lose any hope in the government. But the ones talking about anti-Zionism really are the conspiracy theorists in Istanbul. And it has nothing to do with the debate in Palestine. Zero almost. It really has about this idea that there was this revolution, Young Turk Revolution. Who's behind it? Jewish people are behind it. And of course, Zionism, World Zionism. And that's where you get the modern conspiracy theories coming up in Istanbul during this period that are still very much alive, in fact.
Conspiracy theories are not just a plague of the 21st century, but certainly pre-existed our contemporary era.
Yes, exactly. I couldn't agree more.
If you have to draw some conclusions in relation to your work, what would this be?
The conclusion is something I've already talked about here, is that really we need to rethink how we do history, and we need to revise history. We have, you know, in Middle East history, we have a bit of a problem. We have the problem, oh, that person, she's done that already, I can't do it. Or I've done that, no one else can do it. And there's a lot of territorialness within the field. And I say to people, there's 1,000 books on Napoleon. There's 1,000 books on every American, hundreds of books on George Washington, I'm sure, or on any other history we're looking at. The Dreyfus Affair, think about this. But when we come to Middle East history, we have this idea, oh, they've already done it, let's move on. They already looked at the documents, let's move on. Now, we know in history that it's really seen in the eyes of the beholder, and it's seen that history is written to a great deal in the eyes of the person writing it. So, for example, one of my book reviews, I got criticized on one small issue. It was a Hebrew one, and I felt it was a bit fair in the sense I said, well, Louis is very political, and I can feel this in this book. Yes, for me, it was very important to put the Palestinians on the map. For me, it was essential to put Palestinians on the map and say that, yes, there was a group that called themselves Palestinians, whatever that means, because they have undergone systematic denial of their existence from the start. And in a way, my work argues or engages or counters the work of some of the greatest Arab nationalists that say we were all one Arab people, or we were all Syrians. No, yes, when Palestinians went abroad, they perhaps defined themselves as Syria, the greater area. Many immigrants, many Jews also were Syrians when they went to Argentina or Mexico City or Brooklyn, right? I'm not saying that one thing needs to counter the other or X out the other, but definitely in Palestine by 1914, you have a people that they call themselves El Shaab al Falastini, the Palestinian people. For me, that's very, very important. Number two, something important to stamp, I think the conclusion that I came is that we have adopted wholeheartedly a Zionist narrative that was written in, and this is something I want to develop, that was written by David Ben-Gurion and his friends in the 1930s. The hegemonic labor movement in Israel, and then it's Palestine mandate, but later on, they after the post-state, remember, they are writing the history books. They are writing, and we talk about history of victors, we're talking about political victory over the others. So we have wholeheartedly, we've adopted this idea of settler colonialism. Now, I think settler colonialism is a strong argument for the 20s and 30s in the post-British era. But in the pre-World War I era, I think we've misunderstood a lot of things because of the history of the labor Zionists is actually a settler colonial narrative. It actually really is that, everyone's looking at the farming communities, right, and the colonies. And they're not looking at what's happening in the urban arena. They're not looking about this idea of mobility. And I think that's another thing that we're going to have to look at. When I completed after this article on the Arab Jews, I really saw that there's this mobility that I completely missed in my work. And that mobility is Jews going back and forth from Cairo to Jaffa or Jerusalem. And the connections they have. Whether it's getting rabbinate positions, whether it's trade, whether it's in-laws, visiting in-laws, families, okay, and that Istanbul connection. So the issue of mobility, I come to the conclusion that perhaps I didn't focus enough on mobility also among Palestinians. And Mustafa Manawi has a very interesting book coming out on next year on the Arabs that were in Istanbul. Suddenly, when they're cut off from the empire, what do? They're Ottomans. And where do they go? And I'm really looking forward to that book. So that's some of the conclusions I reached, is that, yeah, we really need to rethink both the Arab nationalist narrative and the Zionist narrative, and to look at local patriotism, to look at what does that mean to be Lebanese or Syrian or Palestinian, and to look at the Yishuv itself, what does it mean to be an Ottoman Jew during this period? And what does that mean when a lot of authors say, oh, there were Arabic-speaking Jews, and someone in Sfat says, yeah, but there's not one Jew who can fill a position that we need him to speak Arabic. They speak, but they don't read and write. So we have a lot to uncover here. I really believe that.
Thank you. And I very much appreciated the fact that you already answered to some of the criticisms that your work has received. And I was going to touch upon that, but as I said, you already answered to that question. So that leaves me with the last question, which is very much about the future. Do you have new projects coming up? Can you give us a sense in a few words of where is your work heading now?
So my work is always usually divided between writing a lot about current politics, mostly Turkish politics, which I want to continue on. But in terms of Ottoman history, my next project, and it's really, you ask at a perfect time, because I'm really pondering on this topic now, but it really is going headed in the direction of the emergence of what I call a Jewish question. And to look at that, exactly that question you asked, what is happening in Istanbul and how is that connected to Palestine? I think I can really I want to develop this more about the Ottoman Jewish soldiers, for example, fighting on behalf of the Ottoman Empire. So in 1912, you have this strange dynamic that the Ottoman governor of Jerusalem, I was just reading this the other day, so in my book, I write about this, but I just say it's of interest. I don't develop it. But the Ottoman government goes to the Jewish colonies of Rishon LeZion and Petah Tikva, and the mayor of Jerusalem, Hassan al-Husseini, also joins him. And at one time, they're meeting, this is 1912. At the same time, you have, just during this period, a little before, you have the breakout of the Libyan-Italian war, the Ottoman-Italian war. So what we're having is we have a lot going on in Palestine, but it really goes back to what's happening in Istanbul. And that's, what is the future of the Jews in the empire? And there's a lot of confusion. I'll tell you that it's interesting, the direction, I'll make it short, but the direction I'm headed in is to see that on one hand, yes, you have anti-Semitism, but the other hand, you also have a very strong pro-Jewish group within the empire. And you have Ottomans saying, Jews could be that loyal community that we need to modernize our empire. So, and the ones that are supporting the Jewish groups, to extent, fear the rise of Greek nationalism within the empire. And the ones that are supporting the more anti-Jewish groups are supporting the Greek group. So that's something I've been, that should come out next year in an article. So what is this anti-Semitism? And why after 1914 do Jews lose their position that they achieved? And they'll never retain it again. They'll never come back to again in modern Turkey. So to answer, the book would look at issues of mobility from the late 1880s with Palestine till about 1940, and end up looking at Turkish Jews. So that's sort of what I want to look at. I want to explore, trying to connect all these dots together. The other thing is that I'm not at all stopping here about writing about Palestinians. So I'm doing this project where I'm reading with a student. Weekly we read the Philistine. It's going to go on for another 8-9 months where I just read Philistine. So I'm coming up with ideas also there to write about. And I'm finding a lot of material that's connected exactly to what I was talking about before, about the rise of anti-Semitism in Istanbul, the fear that the CUP is very pro-Jewish, and what are we going to do about this? How are we going to tackle this? So I'm really interested in looking at internal Palestinian politics also. Why Philistine supports the Damascus more liberal Entente groups while the MPs are supporting the government more. So what are these divisions among the Palestinians and why do they emerge? So either work will look at each community more separately though. I think both works will look at them separately and put that, I've done the conflict or the roots of it, whatever you want to call it. I looked at them together. Now I really think it's time to separate the two groups and look one at Ottoman Jews, the other one on internal Palestinian politics and what does that look like during that period.
This was Louis Fishman, associate professor at Brooklyn College, New York, author of Jews and Palestinians in the Late Ottoman Era, 1908-1914, Claiming the Homeland, published by Edinburgh University Press in 2020. Louis, thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.